je vais passer la parole au professeur Tony Marx. Le professeur Tony Marx a poursuivi une longue carrière d'archéologue. Il a travaillé au Proche-Orient, il a travaillé en Israël, il a travaillé en Europe aussi, dans l'Est de l'Europe en particulier. Et plus récemment, il a travaillé dans la péninsule arabique et il a été un des, si je peux dire, des artisans de ces modèles qui montrent le peuplement moderne de la péninsule arabique.
First, let me apologize for giving this talk in English, but believe me, you would not like to see me attempt it in French. We know that our species arose in Africa some 150,000 to 200,000 years ago. We also know that we are the sole hominin species in the world today. Between these two undisputed facts, there is little else certain about how, when, and why this took place. While the movements of modern people into East Asia and Europe are now just beginning to be explored, the earlier movements out of Africa are more extensively documented. A good deal of related information has recently become available, as well as a number of proposed exit scenarios. The subject of this talk will be how these exit scenarios fit with the presently available temporal, paleoclimatic, and archaeological studies, leading, I hope, to some reasonable conclusions. First, a bit of background. 1980 was a decisive year when the out-of-Africa paradigm was born. Not only did genetic studies place the origins of moderns only in Africa, but morphological restudies of many hominid fossils reclassified the progressive Neanderthals of Skool and Kafsa into anatomical moderns. It also eliminated the presence of Neanderthals from Africa. Combined, the then-held paradigm of multi-regional evolution was overturned. A minor detail. All right. This was the multi-regional hypothesis. And as you notice, they were coming out of the Near East, not out of Africa, but there were various areas of evolution passing from Neanderthals into moderns. Here was the new model. And most importantly, it not only placed Africans as the Africa as the origins of Homo sapiens, but it also required a very rapid replacement of archaic peoples by modern peoples. The then prevailing model, and that's about 1980s, let's say, of replacement came from the position that the European Mousterian material culture represented paleoculture carried by Neanderthals, while the more varied material culture of the Upper Paleolithic Cro-Magnons signified modern behavior. The Aurignacian material culture, with its bone tools, art, ornaments, and blade technology, provided the archaeological evidence for behavioral modernity and became the model for archaeologically recognizing past modern behavior. This association of fossil type and culture type was not new. For instance, in the 1950s, Kenneth Oakley wrote that The Mousterian was the material culture of Neanderthal man. This dichotomy between the Neanderthal Mousterian and the culturally modern Upper Paleolithic became a fundamental part of archaeological thinking, with emphasis placed on assumed differences rather than similarities. This is a typical Mousterian tools from the Levant. Mousterian tools from Africa. This linking of fossil type, material culture, and pre-modern versus modern behavior, and the replacement of one by the other, was accepted for Western Europe and implicitly applied to all the Old World. Thus, if the replacement of the behavioral modern pre-modern Neanderthals by anatomically and behavioral moderns took place in Western Europe, then the same principle should have applied elsewhere. Since the earliest recognized Upper Paleolithic, the Amiran. Was found in the southern Levant, about as close to Africa as you can get, that is, right here. It was a reasonable assumption that the first Upper Paleolithic outside Africa was, in fact, of African origin and was carried directly into the Levant and beyond by migrating African moderns. When did this happen? Using the genetic time scale, it was postulated that this out-of-Africa movement took place somewhere more or less between 60,000 and 40,000 years ago. This correlated well with the assumed origin of the Upper Paleolithic Levantine Amiran at about 50,000 years ago. Thus, this agreement for the timing of the out-of-Africa movement linked it with cultural modernity, as with the Upper Paleolithic. This did, however, raise serious archaeological contradictions. There we go. If the lithic typotechnology of the Mousterian, associated with European and Near Eastern Neanderthals, was proof of a lack of modern cultural abilities, then how did one explain the association of the newly reclassified Levantine moderns with a clearly Mousterian technotypology? Since anatomical moderns, by definition, were supposed to have modern behavior. Even worse, Africa was covered with technologically Mousterian sites, but not a single Neanderthal had ever been there. The field had two options. It was in a state of cognitive dissonance, and to get out of it, it either had to admit that the presence or absence of any particular pattern of material culture was not necessarily a good indicator of behavioral abilities. That is, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. Or, on the other hand, to break with the idea that anatomical modernity necessarily meant behavioral modernity. The field, for the most part, chose the latter, which raised a particularly difficult question. Why and how did anatomically modern Africans, without behavioral modernity, acquire modern behavior after some 50,000 years of getting along just fine, being as dumb as any old Neanderthal? Answering this took a certain mysticism, I would say. For Richard Klein, at least, at about 50,000 years ago, the brains of anatomical moderns finally became sufficiently complex to permit behavioral modernity. The implication was that this was extremely rapid, even revolutionary. For instance, it was suggested that the shift from non-modernity to modernity among anatomical moderns took place among some like the flick of a switch, then spread like a plague among other anatomical moderns. Since all anatomical moderns were in Africa, the dumb ones, the idea of a plague-like spread across all of Africa seems at odds with Africa's size, which is really much larger than we tend to think. We get a misconception of Africa because of the Mercator projection. But if you look at this, Africa is enormous. The idea that some point at 50,000, some group of early moderns became sufficiently complex to have modern behavior, and that all of a sudden it was all over Africa, seems not to be a particularly reasonable idea. In any case, that point of view did not last very long. McBrearty and Brooks made a persuasive case that no such revolution took place, but rather behavioral changes took place over a very long time. In that context, at what point would there be an obvious correlation between developing behavioral modernity and material remains? Did they really develop hand in hand? Could there have been modern behavior without its archaeological signs, such as bone tools and art? It was thought that only behavioral modernity made it possible, and perhaps inevitable, for African moderns to leave Africa, both to adapt to different environments of the northern climes, as well as to out-compete Neanderthals for resources. The seeming proof of that lay in the apparent unsuccessful colonization of the central Levant by anatomical moderns between 130,000 and 80,000 years ago. They were considered behaviorally pre-modern because their material culture was fully Mousterian, because they only got as far north as the central Levant, and because they were seemingly replaced by Neanderthals about 60,000 years ago. Clearly, they were cultural underachievers. The appearance of the Upper Paleolithic Amiran in the southern Levant, with its subsequent development into a technologically fully recognized Upper Paleolithic, everybody recognizes this as Upper Paleolithic, blades, burins, end scrapers, the classic European conception of Upper Paleolithic. That this presence showed that the latter movement of people into the Levant, out of Africa, was successful. It kept going. And it was clearly Upper Paleolithic in spite of the absence of either bone tools, art, ritual burials, the things that we associate with modern culture in the Aurignacian. Geographically, the path out of Africa might have been as far west as Gibraltar. It might have been up through Italy. It might have been through the Near East, and it might have been in the Bab el-Mandab. However, our understanding of the regional climatic conditions at about 50,000 years ago saw Africa, North Africa, and Arabia as cold and dry, while from 130,000 to 70,000 years ago, the same area was thought to have environmental conditions comparable to today's. I can stop now. And you can see, this is not what one would exactly say was a friendly environment. So, the shortest route from the Nile Valley across Sinai into the Levant was most likely for people leaving Africa at this time. It made sense. Not too much desert to go through, down the Nile Valley, which was okay. And after all, it was only a few days' walk through Sinai. It was the route used by Ramesses II's armies going north, by the Hittites' armies going south. It was used by Moses, although it took him 42 years, and by any number of other Pleistocene animals. It was the same route seemingly taken by the anatomical moderns long before 50,000 years ago. Not only did this make sense, it was testable archaeologically. Since the earliest modern culture, that is, the earliest Levantine Upper Paleolithic, was the Amiran, and the earliest Amiran was in the southern Levant, then it was logical to suppose that the Amiran was the material culture carried by these African moderns as they moved north into the Levant. Unfortunately, logic and reality do not always coincide. The Amiran neither occurred in Northeast Africa nor any other part of Africa. The closest African industry to it temporally and technologically was the Taramsin. The problem was that their technologies were not the same. I don't know what has happened here. No, sorry. There we go. The Amiran has two reduction strategies, the way they reduce raw material to produce blanks to make tools. One way was a bidirectional Levallois, which Jean-Jacques has referred to before. It is quite well described. The other is a very upper Paleolithic single platform blade technology that one thinks of quite easily as typically upper Paleolithic. The combination of these two systems together being used by the same people, however, is very unusual. The Taramsin, on the other hand, did not produce the same kind of technology. It didn't have true points. You see in the Amiran, these are all Levallois points. There are none. There may be one, maybe two. The technology of bidirectional reduction, which is classic in the Amiran, didn't occur in the Taramsin. At most, both industries shared a shift from the production of a single wanted product in core reduction to multiple products that could be used. But they did so using very different technologies. And therefore, there was no fulfillment of the prediction that the Amerin came out of Africa and was carried by Africans into the Near East. A quite different route was... God almighty. Quite different route was suggested based on the presence of traditional evidence for behavioral modernity in the Howison's port of South Africa. Not only were there ornaments and decorated ochre present, but also large back geometrics, a traditional modern trait. The slide shown by Jean-Jacques of Meller's movements of people into Asia was based on the presence of these backed lunates. Even better, the Howison's port was dated to about 60,000 years ago, temporally just prior to the postulated movement out of Africa at 50,000 years ago. The problem was that Africa is very far away from everywhere. The movement would take, to get to Arabia, 4,000 miles. This is the equivalent of them coming from northern Germany to Arabia, or from Central Asia to Arabia. Possible, but not terribly likely. At first, it was suggested that the Howison's port moved into East Africa on its way to Australia. While later, some postulated that South African moderns carrying the Howison's port culture moved by boat or raft along the coast of Africa and South Arabia on their way to Australia. These models have a number of serious problems. The Howison's port was not maritime adapted, and most of its sites are well inland. There is no sign of it in East Africa, should they have walked rather than boated. One site, Abdur, number two here, was cited as an example of contemporary maritime adaptation, since it was partly in a coral reef and had numerous bivalves. When studied in detail, however, the bivalves showed no signs of human exploitation, and most of the in-situ fauna were large grassland mammals. Finally, extensive survey along the very narrow Omani coast and its escarpment to the north failed to find a single site that was not either Lower Paleolithic or Holocene. That is the escarpment. It is 2,000 meters, like that. It is very impressive. But when surveyed, what you find is there are literally no sites that could fall into the time range of any kind of movement out of Africa. Since this long section of coast has only trivial submerged continental shelf, either no one floated by it 50,000 years ago, or possibly they never went ashore. So, as of 10 years ago, there was evidence for anatomically but not behaviorally modern people in the Levant sometime between 130,000 and 80,000 years ago. There was, however, no evidence, fossil or archaeological, for the postulated expansion of archaeologically recognizable, behaviorally modern people out of Africa at about 50,000 years ago. If moderns didn't go north into the Levant or along the African coast at 50,000 years ago, When did they leave Africa and by what route? In the last decade, we have learned a great deal. Most importantly, Arabia and much of Northeast Africa, which we once thought were hyper-arid, in fact, were at times grasslands with large lakes, the largest in Arabia exceeding 1,000 square kilometers. Even later, 60 to 70,000 years ago, there were pockets of wetter environment in an otherwise overall dry environment. This was quite a surprise for most archaeologists, since when one thinks of Arabia, it is usually of the Rub al Khali or the Hadramat of Yemen, neither of which are very environmentally hospitable. Even today, however, there are wetter areas of Arabia, such as the Asir Highlands of Yemen or the cloud forests of southern Oman. While Pleistocene climatic conditions fluctuated, they were pronounced wet phases around 125,000, 100,000, and 80,000 years ago. Not surprisingly, recent archaeological work in Arabia has found sites dating to these wetter periods. Based on those dated sites, as well as large numbers of comparable surface sites, it is now possible to say that at least there were two distinct expansions out of Africa eastward into Arabia. Essentially, they were coeval with the long-known movement of anatomically moderns to school in Khafsa in the Near East. Given the pluvial conditions, the wet conditions in Northeast Africa and Arabia, the movement of African populations into the new grasslands of Arabia at about 125,000 years ago may be most easily explained as range expansion. Simply put, like any other animal, humans expanded geographically to fill new areas to which they were already adapted and where there was no competition. The apparently earliest of these range expansions, at about dated to 125,000 years ago, was here to Jebel Faya, about as far from Africa as you can get and still be in Arabia. Maybe 10 kilometers more, but that's about it. The site is a shallow rock shelter. And it has terraces in front of it. It is the only known site in Arabia with intact upper Pleistocene deposits spanning some 100,000 years. Virtually every other rock shelter and cave tested in Arabia, and there have been countless, are strictly Holocene. Don't know why, someday I'll find out, but at the moment, I have no idea. Initial excavations at the site, however, took place in front of the cave in the terraces. Three different assemblages, stratified assemblages, were located. The earliest, which we refer to as Assemblage C, is mainly a workshop consisting of a co-association of bifacial reduction, levallois production, and blade production. This co-association was common at the same time in East Africa, but is unknown in the Levant, it is unknown in Iran, it is unknown in India. Therefore, the assumption of links to Africa is reasonable, if not 100% proven. Included among this assemblage are foliates, small bifaces, very typical of what we call the East African Middle Stone Age, and a series of Levallois flakes, and what Africans refer to as core axes, which are not known outside of Africa, but this may simply be a matter of what people call things. I'm sure you can find something like that in Europe if you look hard enough. But they tend to be quite typical in Africa and not so in the Acheulean of Arabia or the Near East. At the moment, we really don't know what this assemblage means. It's the only one we have in all of Arabia that's like it. It does not seem to have spread eastward beyond Arabia. That is, so far, nothing has been published from India that looks like it. But it may be the initial movement of moderns that kept going. We just simply don't have the data to back it up. The second expansion into Arabia dates at least to 106,000, and maybe as early as 125. It may be about the same time period as the others. Unlike the Faya assemblage, the link to Africa is the dominant use of a very specific reduction called Nubian. It doesn't look much different from other pointy cores, but it's formed by two blows, which makes a very steep dorsal ridge, which controls the flake that you then strike from this side. And this this technology first appeared at Sai Island on the Nile Valley about 160,000 years ago. By 125,000 years ago, it had spread up into central Egypt. One has to say here, northern Egypt is a problem because there are really no Pleistocene sediments. They're either buried by later Nile sediments or have been blown away. So there's always this unknown little area up here. But there is no question that Nubian technology spread widely this way and appears sporadically down in East Africa as well. The one thing about the Nubians is that it's clear that what we find here in Arabia is virtually the same as what we find in Africa. The movements between them seem clear, but it is not found in Eastern Arabia. If we're looking for a group that left Africa, spread to Arabia, kept going toward Australia, this doesn't seem to be the one. It seems to have not gotten beyond this central line in Arabia. Now, while the African and Arabian Nubian are very similar, there's some differences. The African Nubian produced Levallois flakes. Those cores look like they should produce points, but for some reason in Africa they don't. You don't have points, you have flakes. In Arabia, you have points. The cores are the same, but there's also a much greater tendency for elongation in Arabia. long pieces rather than short, wide pieces. Same technology, but different emphases producing slightly different results. Now, in Arabia, sometime after this spread of Nubian, there is a development within the Nubian to what we are calling Mudayan. The basic technology remains the same, but there are changes which are really quite important if we're looking at what happens to people leaving Arabia. Although all the Mudayan sites that we now know are on the surface, there are reasons to believe that the Mudayan is truly more recent than the Arabian Nubian. First, although assemblages of both occur very close together on the same surfaces, they have different patination. The Mudayan is lighter in color from chemical weathering, less chemical weathering than the Arabian Nubian. Also, the distribution of the sites is very different. The Nubian, the Arabian Nubian, is all over the place. This was after the third season, after the fifth season, there are probably three times as many black dots, but no more red dots. These Mudayan sites are clustered around fossil springs, suggesting that the climate was drier, they were tethered to water, and you had less mobility. And that means that they are younger than probably 80,000. But how much younger, we still don't know. There's reason to believe, however, that they may be at about 50,000. They may be the link to the Near East. The reason we say that is because if you look at the technology, the Amiran and the Mudayan look very much the same. I know they're rocks, they look funny, but there are those of us who love them. And this is what we get in archaeology in prehistory. We get rocks. So if you look at this core and this core, bidirectional reduction on a broad, flat surface. Also, the Nubian reduction, Nubian reduction. Difference, though, is that in the Nubian, Arabian Nubian, very steep dorsal ridge. By the time we get to the Mudayan, the cores are becoming flatter. And as they become flatter, they can produce not only a point, but a series of blades. So you're producing multiple products that you want to use as opposed to just a single product. This occurs in both the Mudayan and the Amiran. Now, there are some very serious differences, one of which is the Mudayan never seemed to learn how to make tools. I mean, they're extremely rare to have anything that an archaeologist would call a burin or an end scraper or a denticulate. They're very, very few tools. The Amiran, there are lots of them. Very typical Upper Paleolithic looking tools. This may have to do with differences in the degree of mobility, how long a site was actually used. How many times did people resharpen pieces of rock that they were using for cutting or scraping. Hard to know, but that's one possible explanation. The problem of saying that the Mudaean is the progenitor of the Amiran is that it's not dated. It's also the nearest Amiran site from a Mudaean site is 2,000 kilometers apart. Very hard to make arguments that one influenced the other. There are, however, some hints that this may be the case. While it's not possible to prove contact between people carrying the Arabian-Nubian and those from the Levant with typical Levawah technology, even the few years of work in Arabia has demonstrated a marked geographic overlap between Nubian-like sites and Levantine-like sites. And one has to keep in mind here, we're looking at perhaps 10 years' worth of studies. Nothing compared to the 100 years' worth in the Levant or the 60, 70 years' worth in Northeast Africa. But you can see there are, way up in northern Arabia, there are sites with Nubian characteristics, and some in southern Israel as well. More surprisingly, perhaps, there are sites in central Arabia and in southern Arabia which have assemblages that look Levantine. Particularly, they look what we would call Tabun B, that is late Levantine Musteri, dating around 60,000. 60,000, 65,000. If we look at the large picture regarding the movement of Africans out of Africa, obviously it's complex. Given the number of different archaic hominids that expanded out of Africa during the Lower and Middle Pleistocene, it is not surprising that anatomically modern folk did so as well, with or without modern behavior. Like all before them, whether biped or quadruped, they expanded their range when permitted by the presence of newly suitable Arabian environments. Clearly, there was not a single out of Africa event. Only the Arabian Nubian, however, seems to have adapted to Arabia by a fusion with technologies from the southern Levant and Africa, eventually leading to a pattern of the earliest Levantine Upper Paleolithic, the Amiran. Now here, this Upper Paleolithic tools, Levawah points, Middle Paleolithic tools, the dominant forms that we find throughout Africa and the Near East at this period. If you look at the distributions here, the Nubian, the Arabian Nubian and the Mudaean cluster with the Amiran, the earliest Upper Paleolithic, here. While the material culture of those African moderns who went to school in Kafsa, Tabun C, cluster with the African Nubian and non-African Nubian cultures. It looks as if the people who went directly to the Levant, probably through Sinai, never really adapted in any particularly noticeable way. They kept their technology, they kept their culture, they kept the way they made tools, they kept the kind of tools they made, And they did reasonably well. Those in Arabia, however, changed. They developed toward what we call Upper Paleolithic. At least three industrial distinct groups expanded out of Africa. One went directly into the southern, central Levant. One, not shown here, went all the way up to here in Faya, Eastern Arabia. The other moved into southern Arabia and developed into what is probably, well, is analogous to the earliest Upper Paleolithic in the Levant. Now, it might be argued that the Arabian-Nubian developed the long-present Levantine traits independent of Levantine input. Maybe there wasn't any contact. But given the geographic overlap between Arabian-Nubian and Levantine sites in Arabia and the southern Levant, however, postulating direct interaction is not only reasonable, but certainly proven in one case. The Manon fossil skeleton skull dated to 55,000 years ago, which is a clear Neanderthal-Sapien hybrid. There had to be some contact. More generally, our present population didn't get our Neanderthal genes through stimulus diffusion or parallel independent invention. At the moment, therefore, we can see three different episodes of expansion out of Africa between 130,000 and 100,000 years ago, but none around 50,000 years ago. All three took place within the context of archaeological pre-modern technology without any archaeological signs of modern behavior. And I would argue about those shells. Only one of them, after some 50,000 years in Arabia and the southernmost Levant, developed toward a limited number of those traits which we archaeologically associate with modern behavior. In short, while the early signs of behavioral modernity certainly were present in South Africa, in North Africa, they appeared as well independently in Arabia. The expansion of anatomically modern people out of Africa into the Levant and Arabia was unrelated to behavioral modernity as we recognize it archaeologically. And, as I've said before, may be explained as simple range expansion. Here I would, Jean-Jacques and I have slightly different perceptions of the climate. In desert conditions, yes, they prevent movement. But I would put it the other way, that good climatic conditions encourage movement. You don't you expand into areas that are not occupied if you're adapted to them. And it's the positive climatic conditions that moved people out of Africa. On the other hand, the idea of archaeologically visible behavioral modernity as a necessary catalyst for the expansion from Africa simply is no longer tenable. Nor is the insistence that Africans left Africa some 50,000 years ago. We have no evidence for this. Okay. How should we think about Arabia and the part it played both as an origin for the expansion of behaviorally modern people into the rest of the world, and as a place where behavioral modernity developed among migrant Africans over some 50,000 years. One way of looking at it occurred when the Faya discovery was published in Science. Then Richard Klein was asked by a reporter what he thought, and he said that people had not expanded out of Africa, but that Africa had expanded. While geographers may disagree, Richard had a point. With the onset of wetter conditions at about 125,000 years ago, there was a continuous band of lakes and grasslands across North Africa and Arabia. In that sense, Arabia was merely the eastern end of a huge east-west swatch of savanna into which people spread following their traditional prey. This tells us why they went into Arabia. It doesn't inform us, however, how and why these migrants became behaviorally modern over the following millennia. While it is possible, I suppose, that behavioral modernity developed simultaneously across all of Africa and Arabia, regardless of specific environmental and social conditions, it seems unlikely. I would suggest that the pace and form of emerging modern behavior was situational. In the case of Arabia, a number of factors played their parts. First, Arabia is varied topographically with a number of different regional settings surrounding the central flat part of the what we think of Arabia, the Rub el Khali, the Nejd deserts, but along the western coast and along the southern coast, you have quite different environments and ones which could sustain themselves under arid conditions. The large area of Arabia, and it is very large, at first devoid of competitors, might well have encouraged increased group mobility. People spread out into an unoccupied area. And this would result in very low population densities. Since it appears that movements into Arabia during wet periods came both from Africa and the Levant and overlap geographically, encounters between these two quite different peoples was inevitable, although perhaps not frequent. It would seem that from our Neanderthal genes, that such encounters were not always hostile. Since Arabia saw a series of climatic shifts, wow. There we go. Oh, I see. Okay. Since Arabia saw a series of climatic shifts between 130,000 and 50,000 years ago, some quite severe, parts of Arabia, particularly the central area, went from being habitable to being uninhabitable, back and forth. Other parts of Arabia, however, saw less extreme climatic swings. At least three areas would have been reasonable refugia, even under the most severe dry spells. There's one there, and the Urshak Valley, that is what is now the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf only became the Persian Gulf 10,000 years ago. Until that time, it was probably like the lower Nile Valley, incredibly rich, and we know nothing about it. And probably never will. It's underwater. The climatic swings would have caused dispersals during wet periods and aggregations during dry periods, so that innovations, new ideas, and even foreign technologies would have been widely spread. I believe this latter situation is the key to understanding the emergence of behavioral modernity in Arabia. From a technological perspective, it is clear that by 50,000 years ago, Arabian and southern Levantine peoples had not only bred with each other, but had also merged their different technologies, forming what we archaeologically recognize as the earliest Upper Paleolithic. Yet, to date, this earliest Upper Paleolithic, the Imiran, is known only as far south as the southern Levant. Why not in Arabia proper? The answer seems to lie in climatic differences between Arabia and the Levant. As the climate of Arabia dried, the climate of the northern Negev was getting wetter. Here's Arabia, southern Negev, northern is getting wetter. And I would suggest that this encouraged the movement northward of people into the better climates. At that point, the beginning of the Imiran, it is getting very dry in Arabia, and the contacts between the Levant and Arabia seem to be broken. There is some evidence, a little evidence, for minor southern movements of Levantine Upper Paleolithic peoples into northern Arabia during brief periods of climatic amelioration. A site here, a site there, but not many. Beyond that, at about 50,000, the cultural developments in Arabia and the Levant went their separate ways. Thank you.